fundamental crisis of the over-administrated society. This crisis requires a complete reversal of the logic of one-dimensionality so as to prevent the very system from grinding to a halt through the reams of bureaucratic paperwork. With the final collapse of any hope of the Marxist model in the 1970s, the changing function of critical theory should not come as a complete surprise. Late capitalism finds itself unable to provide free space for the emancipatory tendencies which it needs to guarantee its own continued world domination in a context characterized by a rapidly decaying communist world and a third world unable to successfully modernize. What this analysis entails as the precondition for a meaningful relaunching of critical theory and a full understanding of its heritage is self-historization within a new periodization of 20th century capitalism. In short, it means locating the one-dimensionality thesis as the critical awareness of the transitional phase between entrepreneurial and advanced capitalism, while locating traditional Marxism as a critique of entrepreneurial capitalism and searching for a yet-to-be-developed critical perspective to deal with the present. Already prefigured at the turn of the century when the crisis of entrepreneurial capitalism seemed to have entered into its final phase, but fully institutionalized only after the 1929 crash. The age of one-dimensionality means the increasing extension of collective capital over every facet of life, even to the point of reconstituting character structure and personality to accord with the new requirements of rationalization. The first 30 years of this century are marked not only by the blossoming of a variety of Marxist theories, but also by the prefiguration of various successful and unsuccessful institutions of the coming welfare state. After pre-World War, progressive legislation, scientific management, and the integration of earlier forms of opposition, essentially organized labor, have been finally institutionalized during and after the New Deal, such strictures as prohibition and other overtly repressive projects could be dropped. The new situation no longer required them to generate the new phase of capitalist realization. As a matter of fact, they stood in its way. Page Roman 19. In certain European states, such institutionalization was only possible through authoritarian means. In the U.S., the lack of a powerful opposition was a major factor in making for a peaceful and relatively smooth transition. Thus, the institutional shift of entrepreneurial capitalism to the New Deal meant a rationalization of capital mediated by the state and a redirection of extensive into intensive growth. Footnote 7, text. The tendency toward one-dimensionality resulted from a massive attempt to annihilate all specificity and otherness left over from previous social formation so as to create the conditions necessary for this restructuring of capitalism. Taylorization, capital-intensive technology, the culture industry, and consumerism combined within a production system that was based on the automobile and military expenditures. And this facilitated the penetration of capitalist relations into all crevices of everyday life. One dimensionality of the tendencial fulfillment of the dialectic of enlightenment, which Horkheimer and Adorno unjustifiably dehistorized and projected back into the whole trajectory of Western civilization from Odysseus to Hitler, assumed the characteristics that Marcuse has so trenchantly described and eliminated all remaining obstacles. The homogenization and depersonalization associated with this period, that is, the domination of the concept and of capital's abstract instrumental reason, constitute the historical limit of this transitory rationalizing phase. The full triumph of non-dimensionality corresponded to the exhaustion of the model that generated it. Ultimately, this required a reversal of the logical of one-dimensionality, which was greatly facilitated by the system's successful obliteration of all potential and even imagined internal opposition during the Cold War and its aftermath. No longer meaningfully challenged, the system can allow harmless new forms of institutional free space within which spontaneity and negativity thrive and can thus generate much needed control mechanism. In fact, the system's immediate response is to attempt to generate such opposition. This explains the recent phenomenon of counter-bureaucratic bureaucracies that tend to reproduce the very problems they are meant to solve. The contradictions remain that for the planned society, effective negativity must be spontaneous and unplanned and therefore cannot be bureaucratically blotted out. Page Roman 20. At best, it can only be encouraged by creating free industrial space within which to develop. While it is not at all clear whether the growing institutional liberalization will succeed in providing the needed negativity, this new social tendency paves the way for a development and reception of critical theory that has hitherto been unimaginable. Potential assimilation by the administrative apparatus is no longer a major danger when the other side of integration is precisely freedom to formulate even emancipatory projects, and when the latent revolutionary otherness within which the first generation of critical theorists operated has turned out to be a mythical leftover of a never fully transcended Marxist heritage. In the newly created institutional free space, critical theory can not only renew itself, but can also seek the kind of broad, popular base previously ruled out in earlier formulations of the theory. An historically accurate reconstruction of critical theory's own trajectory from its inception becomes a precondition for any future renewal. In this respect, the essential Frankfurt School reader should greatly aid in setting the historical record straight on any number of as yet incompletely investigated topics. The selected texts present critical theory at a relatively open and not yet fully esoteric stage where a pessimistic philosophy of history has not yet swallowed social analysis. The possibility of theoretical renewal, especially in the eras of political and cultural theory, depends on our active assimilation of precisely this stage of the theory, which yields the first approximations toward a new critical sociology and a new philosophy of history with emancipation in mind. We might say that the text in their uneasy unity constitute a prolegomenon to any future critical theory of society. Signed, Paul Picon. Page Roman 21. Notes. 1. For a detailed discussion of this issue, see Andrew Arado's introduction to Part Roman 1 as well as the essays included there. 2. Compare Martin J. The Dialectical Imagination, Boston, 1973, pages 65 and following. 3. George Lukacs, History and Class Consciousness, translated by Rodney Livingston, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1971, page 10. 4. Compare Benjamin Snow, Introduction to Adorno's The Actuality of Philosophy. Talos, Roman 31, Spring 1977, pages 113 through 119. 5. For a systematic critique of the Frankfurt School's reception of psychoanalysis, see Jessica Benjamin, The End of Internalization, Adorno's Social Psychology, in Talos, Roman 32, Summer 1977, pages 42 through 46. 6. Jürgen Habermas, Legitimation Crises, translated by Thomas McCarthy, Boston, 1975, pages 61 through 68. 7. Compare Mihaly Vaidya, Crisis and the Way Out, The Rise of Fascism in Italy and Germany, in Talos, Roman 21, Summer 1972, pages 3 through 26, and Habermas, Legitimation Crisis, in the work cited, pages 24 and following, and pages 33 and following.